When you picture like the ultimate masterclass in corporate strategy, there's usually a very specific image that comes to mind, right? You probably imagine this sleek, glass-walled boardroom.
Right, yeah. Lots of whiteboards.
Exactly. You see these executives in tailored suits looking at projection screens, and they're mapping out these high-level concepts like counter positioning and market saturation and tax optimization.
Right, this is a highly structured, very sterile environment because we tend to associate survival and market dominance with, spreadsheets and very calculated, quiet maneuvering.
Right, but what if the ultimate blueprint for corporate survival wasn't drafted in a boardroom at all? Like, what if one of the most ruthless, adaptable, and honestly brilliant business empires of the 20th century was actually built by a bunch of scruffy guys playing blues covers in smoky London clubs?
It is wild to think about.
It really is. Well, welcome to the deep dive. If you are joining us as a learner today, we have an incredible stack of sources for you. We're looking at biographies, financial records, studio notes, you name it. And our mission today is to extract the brilliant, often entirely accidental strategies that kept one specific entity culturally relevant through shifting decades.
Yeah, and surviving things that would destroy normal companies.
Exactly. Today, we are looking at the Rolling Stones. Now, you likely know the iconic tongue logo, and you definitely know the guitar riffs. But what we're pulling from our sources today is, well, it's far more surprising. Their trajectory from a garage band to global billionaires is this unbelievable masterclass in branding and just cutthroat adaptability. Okay, let's unpack this.
Right, so to really understand how they pulled this off, we have to start by setting the baseline. Our source material tracks the band from their true inception back in 1962, and what stands out immediately is just how uncalculated it is at the beginning.
Oh, completely uncalculated.
Yeah, I mean, you have Mick Jagger and Keith Richards, who were childhood friends from Dartford, and they literally just run into each other on platform two of the Dartford railway station.
And Jagger is holding these specific records, right?
Exactly. He's carrying Muddy Waters and Chuck Berry records under his arm. And that shared, genuine love of Chicago blues, that's the initial spark. It wasn't a business plan. It was just pure, unadulterated musical passion.
Yeah, the narrative through line in these early years is fascinating because they really do start out with this intense authenticity. I mean, the sources detail how their original guitarist, Brian Jones, actually named the band in a moment of pure improvisation.
Right, he was on the phone, wasn't he?
Yes, on the phone with a journalist from Jazz News, and the writer asked for the band's name, and they didn't even have one yet. They were literally nameless.
That's amazing.
So Jones just he looks down at a Muddy Waters LP that's lying on the floor, sees the track Rolling Stone, and basically makes history right there on the spot.
There was absolutely no grand design. I mean, they were blues purists who just wanted to play American music. But that purity was about to collide with a very, very different kind of genius, which completely altered their trajectory.
Enter Andrew Lugoldum.
Oh, man,
He
yes.
becomes their manager in 1963, and he is only 19 years old.
That's the craziest part to me.
Right. He's actually younger than the band members themselves. The sources note he was so young he couldn't legally obtain an agent's license or even sign contracts without his mother co-signing them.
His mom had to sign the papers.
Yeah, his mom. So how does a teenager take a blues cover band and turn them into a global cultural phenomenon?
He does it through pure calculated counter-programming. Initially, Oldham considered putting them in matching suits, which was the exact strategy Brian Epstein had used to make the Beatles massively successful.
Right, the whole clean-cut thing.
Yeah, but Oldham quickly realized that, playing by someone else's rules is a losing game. You literally cannot beat the Beatles at being the Beatles.
So he completely throws out the suits, just abandons it. He decides he wants a band that is the absolute polar opposite of the Fab Four. The sources quote him saying he wanted to make the Stones, quote, a raunchy, gamey, unpredictable bunch of undesirables.
What a quote.
Right. He wanted them to look threatening and uncouth. He even went so far as to remove their piano player, Ian Stewart, from the official lineup.
And not because of his playing.
Exactly. It wasn't because Stewart couldn't play. It was strictly a visual branding decision. Oldham decided Stewart didn't look the part, and he basically argued that six faces were just too many for fans to remember in a press photograph.
What's fascinating here is how Oldham intuitively understood market saturation long before it was a common business buzzword. The market already had its clean-cut heroes. If you try to be the second best version of a clean-cut hero, you just fail.
Yeah, you become a knockoff.
Exactly. So if we connect this to your own professional or creative life, like as a listener, When you can't beat the competition at their own game, you have to invert the game. You don't compete, you contrast.
It perfectly mirrors the mechanics of professional wrestling, actually.
Oh, how so?
Well, in wrestling, you have the babyface, you know, the squeaky clean hero that the crowd is supposed to cheer for. But a babyface is really nothing without a heel. The villain who breaks the rules, sneers at the crowd, wears black. The Beatles were the ultimate babyfaces. Oldham looked at the Stones and essentially said, "You are going to be the heels."
And that heel strategy immediately paid off in the boardroom, surprisingly enough. Decca Records had famously rejected the Beatles a year prior, which was a historic mistake they were desperate not to repeat.
Yeah, the biggest fumble in music history.
Absolutely. So when Oldham brings them the anti-Beatles, Decca completely caves. They gave the Stones a recording contract with unprecedented terms. I mean, they secured full artistic control, 3 times the typical royalty rate for a new act, and most importantly, ownership of their master tapes.
Let me stop you there, actually, because the concept of master tapes comes up a lot in music history, but it isn't always explained. For the listener, why is owning the master tapes such a massive piece of leverage?
It's basically the holy grail of the music business.
Yeah.
The master is the original, final recording of a song. If a record label owns it, they control how that specific recording is used forever.
Right.
They can put it in movies, commercials, compilations, whatever, and they take the lion's share of the money. By owning their own masters, the Rolling Stones essentially licensed their music to Decca rather than signing their creations away. They retained ultimate control over their product.
That is an incredible power move for a brand new band. And Decca even let them record outside of the usual, you know, pristine corporate studios. It went to Regent Sound Studios. The sources describe this place as a mono facility that literally had egg boxes glued to the ceiling for sound treatment.
Right, which sounds totally absurd, but there's actual acoustic science behind it. When sound waves hit a flat, hard wall, they bounce right back, creating a flutter echo that just ruins a recording.
Right.
The irregular, bumpy shape of an egg box actually scatters those sound waves in different directions, deadening the room. That makeshift acoustic treatment is exactly what allowed them to create what Oldham called their signature wall of noise.
But the irony of this whole manufactured rivalry between the Beatles and the Stones is just incredible. I mean, they were marketed as bitter opposites. Yet the sources show that John Lennon and Paul McCartney actually visited the Stones in the studio and literally gave them their second single.
Yeah, the great rivalry was kind of a media invention.
Exactly. Lennon and McCartney had a partially finished song called I Wanna Be Your Man. They finished it in the corner of the studio and just handed the copyright over to the Stones. And it charted at number 12 in the UK. The Ultimate Bad Boys got their first major career boost from the Ultimate Good Boys.
It's a perfect example of the disconnect between a public brand and private reality. But because of how they positioned themselves, they obviously couldn't rely on Lennon and McCartney forever. As we trace their evolution from 1965 to 1967, they hit this critical structural bottleneck.
Right, the money issue.
Yeah, the bad boy gimmick was working wonders for their image, but it was basically failing financially.
Because of how royalties work, Oldham looked at the accounting and realized they were just bleeding money. When you play a cover song, the mechanical royalties, you know, the money generated every time a record is pressed and sold that goes to the person who originally wrote the song.
Exactly.
Oldham pointed out they had no financial future just playing the songs of, as he put it, middle-aged blacks, because they were missing out on the primary revenue stream of the music industry, which is songwriting royalties.
So Oldham essentially forces Jagger and Richards into a room and tells them they aren't allowed to come out until they figure out how to write original songs.
Which is wild.
It's a terrifying constraint for any creative professional who is used to just interpreting other people's work. They had to completely transition from being performers to being architects.
And that forced evolution leads directly to their first international number one hit in 1965. Satisfaction. Or, Satisfaction. But the mechanics behind how that song came together completely challenged the myth of solitary artistic genius.
Oh, absolutely.
That iconic guitar riff was played by Keith Richards through a fuzz box. For anyone unfamiliar, a fuzz box is a guitar pedal that deliberately distorts the audio signal. It clips the sound waves, making the guitar sound really gritty, thick, and almost horn-like. But Richards didn't intend for that to be the final sound at all. He was using the fuzz box purely to record a scratch track.
Exactly. And a scratch track is just a rough, disposable draft. It's recorded early in the studio process just to serve as a metronome, really, or a guide for the other musicians to follow. Richards fully intended to throw that fuzzy guitar recording in the trash and replace it with a proper brass section later.
Wait, he wanted horns on that riff.
Yeah, he wanted a full horn section playing that iconic line.
But they didn't do it. They listened back to the rough draft, and the rest of the band, along with the engineers, realized the scratch track was actually the magic. They kept the mistake. It really makes you wonder how much of their massive success was just a willingness to embrace happy accidents. They didn't let their ego get in the way of what was clearly working.
And that flexibility became their defining trait. You see this creative expansion just explode on their 1966 album, Aftermath, which was their first record composed entirely of Jagger and Richards' originals. Brian Jones, who's kind of stepping back from the core leadership at this point, finds a new role as an absolute mad scientist of instrumentation.
Right, he's bringing in all these crazy instruments.
Yeah, he starts bringing in completely foreign textures to rock music.
He plays the sitar on Paint It Black, he adds the Appalachian dulcimer to Lady Jane, and he even plays the marimbas on Under My Thumb. They aren't just an anti-Beatles blues cover band anymore. They are creating their own highly distinct sonic landscape.
But, you know, as their artistic credibility peaked, a new problem emerged. Because they had so successfully convinced the public that they were dangerous outlaws, they accidentally attracted the attention of real-world authorities.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
The manufactured image was colliding with reality.
It's like a corporate mascot suddenly taking over the boardroom. The outlaw image stopped being a marketing tool and just became their actual operational reality. It all kicks off in early 1967 with a massive drug bust sparked by a sensationalist newspaper, The News of the World. The paper ran this three-part expose claiming they had spotted Mick Jagger at an exclusive club taking Benzedrine and showing off hashish.
But the reporter had actually made a massive mistake, right?
Yes. The reporter had mistaken Brian Jones for Jagger.
Unbelievable.
Jagger naturally filed a libel writ against the paper, but the crosshairs were already squarely on them. A week later, Sussex police raided a party at Keith Richards' home, an estate called Redlands. The sources indicate the police were tipped off by the newspaper, who in turn had been tipped off by Richards' own chauffeur.
Wow, an inside job. And the authorities really threw the book at him to make an example. I mean, Jagger got a 3-month prison sentence just for possessing 4 amphetamine tablets.
Yeah.
And Richards got a full year simply for allowing cannabis to be smoked on his property.
A year in prison for that.
Yeah. It was such an aggressive legal overreach that it actually sparked a backlash from the establishment itself. The editor of the highly conservative Times newspaper, William Rees-Mogg, ran a famous editorial titled, "Who Breaks a Butterfly Upon a Wheel?" He basically argued that Jagger was being targeted not for his crime, but for his cultural influence.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. Does a brand eventually force the behavior of the people inside it? Like, did pretending to be dangerous inevitably drag them into genuine darkness?
Yeah.
Because the consequences were devastating, particularly for Brian Jones.
Yeah, it got very dark.
He couldn't handle the pressure or the outlaw lifestyle. His drug use escalated to the point where he couldn't even secure a U.S. visa to tour. In June 1968, he officially leaves the band, and then, less than a month later, he tragically drowns under mysterious circumstances in his swimming pool.
It was a brutal loss, and it really marked the definitive end of their innocence. 2 days after his death, they played a previously scheduled free concert in London's Hyde Park, which basically transformed into a massive, somber tribute.
The sources describe 250,000 fans gathering, 250,000 people. Jagger read an excerpt from a Percy Bysshe Shelley poem, and they released thousands of white butterflies.
Wow.
But that same outlaw gravity they cultivated pulled them right into the Altamont Free Concert tragedy just a few months later.
Right. This raises an important question about the limits of branding. When you actively court controversy and position yourself as the enemy of polite society, eventually, polite society will try to crush you. Or worse, the elements of society you attract will crush you. They attempt to host a free festival in California at the Altamont Speedway. And to manage the crowd, they make the disastrous decision to hire the Hell's Angels motorcycle gang as security.
A terrible, terrible idea.
It descended into absolute chaos. A fan named Meredith Hunter was beaten and stabbed to death by the Angels right in front of the stage while the band was performing.
It's just horrific. The darkness of the brand had become totally unmanageable at that point. The threat wasn't a marketing gimmick anymore, you know. It was lethal, which explains why their next pivot is so jarring, but arguably their most brilliant. Moving into the 1970s and 1980s, the Rolling Stones survive by doing the very last thing you would expect from anarchists.
Right.
They bureaucratize.
Exactly. They realize that to survive the chaos of the 1960s, They can't just be a band anymore. They have to build a world-class administrative structure around themselves. It starts with a ruthless legal maneuver to get out of their contracts with their manager, Alan Klein, and Decca Records.
Yeah, they owed Decca one final single credited to Jagger and Richards. So what do? They write an intentionally unreleasable, incredibly crude track called Schoolboy Blues.
They did it on purpose.
Entirely on purpose. They hand it over to fulfill the absolute bare minimum of the contract, knowing Decca could never, ever put it on the radio, effectively forcing their own independence.
That is a highly calculated move.
Yeah.
And the moment they are free, they establish their own record company, simply called Rolling Stones Records. This is when they truly begin building a visual corporate identity that functions entirely independently of the individual band members.
This is the debut of the famous Lips and Lopping Tongue logo, right?
Yes. It first appears on the insert of the 1971 album Sticky Fingers. Now, a lot of people assume the tongue logo is a drawing of Mick Jagger's mouth, but the sources clarify that the designer, John Posh, was actually inspired by the Hindu goddess Kali at Jagger's suggestion.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they built an icon. But their real business acumen was happening behind closed doors with their financial structuring.
Yes, the taxes. In 1972, facing crushing tax rates in Britain that could take up to 90% of their earnings.
90%.
I know. The band effectively became a multinational corporation. They left the UK to become tax exiles in France, and they established this complex network of holding companies, most notably one called Promo Group, with offices in the Netherlands.
I really want to break down the mechanics of this because it's staggering. A holding company doesn't actually produce anything, right? It doesn't press records or book tours. It simply holds assets, yeah, like intellectual property and copyrights. But why the Netherlands?
Because of international tax treaties. The Netherlands did not directly tax royalty payments moving across its borders. So when the Rolling Stones sold a record in Japan or America, the royalty money didn't flow back to the heavily taxed UK. It flowed into their holding company in the Netherlands, effectively shielding their wealth.
That's brilliant. According to the financial records in our sources, through this arrangement, the band reportedly paid a tax rate of just 1.6% on total earnings of £242 million over 20 years.
1.6%?
Yeah.
I look at the 1970s Rolling Stones, and I don't see a rock band. I see a Fortune 500 board of directors. You see the same ruthless discipline when Ronnie Wood joins the band as a guitarist in 1975.
Well, that's a perfect example. From the outside, joining the Rolling Stones looks like entering a blood pact, you know, a brotherhood of outlaws. But in reality, it was a corporate hiring. When Ronnie Wood joined, he didn't become a business partner with Equity the Enterprise. He was hired as a W-2 salaried employee.
He was on salary.
Yes. It wasn't until the early 1990s that he was finally made a full financial partner.
That is just hilarious. But the wild thing is, the rock and roll chaos was still happening parallel to these incredibly dry, calculated boardroom decisions. The two lives were constantly bleeding into each other, like during the 1977 El Macambo gig in Toronto.
Yeah, that is one of the most tense moments in their history. Jagger books a live recording session at a small club in Toronto to gather material for a live album.
Mm-hmm.
To keep it a secret from the press, a local radio station runs a contest for free tickets to see a different band, April Wine.
Sneaky.
Yeah, so the winners show up and the Rolling Stones walk on stage.
And the club gig is brilliant. Margaret Trudeau, the wife of the Canadian Prime Minister, is literally partying with them. But while the band is executing this brilliant piece of live marketing, Keith Richards is facing a scenario that could end the band forever.
Richards had arrived in Canada and was almost immediately raided by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police. They found 22 grams of heroin in his hotel room. He was charged with importing narcotics into the country, a charge that carried a minimum sentence of 7 years in prison.
He could have been locked away for a decade. The legal battle dragged on for over a year, creating massive instability before he finally received a suspended sentence that simply required him to play a couple of free charity concerts.
That's quite the plea deal.
Yeah, and the gravity of that near miss finally pushed Richards to get clean.
But just as they stabilize internally, they face a massive external threat, which is the rise of punk rock in the mid-1970s. Suddenly, bands like the Sex Pistols and the Clash are changing the entire market. The Rolling Stones, who invented the anti-establishment attitude, were now being viewed by the new generation as bloated, wealthy dinosaurs.
Because they were the establishment at that point.
Exactly, they were the establishment.
But because their entire foundation was built on adaptability, they simply counter-programmed the culture again. In 1978, they released the album Some Girls. They strip away the excess. It's fast, basic, aggressive rock and roll that directly responds to the energy of punk, while also incorporating the massive market trend of disco with the hit Miss You. They adapted to the market forces, and it was a massive success.
If we connect this to the bigger picture, it proves that their longevity wasn't an accident. I mean, they melted the highest grossing tour of 1981. By 1982, they leveraged their sustained relevance to sign a new deal with CBS Records for a reported $50 million, which was the biggest record contract in history up to that point.
That is just an insane amount of money for 1982.
Yeah. The musicologist Robert Palmer noted in our sources that they endured because they were rooted in the traditional verities of rhythm and blues. But looking at the whole timeline, they survived punk, drugs, and taxes because underneath the leather jackets was a highly disciplined, pragmatic machine.
So what does this all mean? When you step back and look at the whole picture, the Rolling Stones didn't last 60 plus years just because they wrote catchy songs. They lasted by executing brilliant counterpositioning when they realized they couldn't be the Beatles. They lasted by embracing technical constraints in the studio, like turning a scratch track into a generational anthem.
Right.
They survived the lethal reality of their own outlaw mythos. And ultimately, they thrived by building an impenetrable corporate structure.
The real takeaway here, especially as you navigate your own professional hurdles, is that to remain a rebel, you must master the rules of the game better than the establishment itself. The Stones evolved continuously from blues purists to manufactured anti-heroes to tax-savvy CEOs. True freedom to create doesn't come from ignoring the system. It comes from learning how the mechanics of the system work and then building your own structure to protect your art.
Which brings us right back to that boardroom we talked about at the beginning. If the quintessential image of rock and roll rebellion, you know, the mismatched clothes, the sneers, the bad boy attitude, if that was originally dreamed up as a marketing ploy by a 19-year-old manager looking to sell records, well, it makes you wonder. How much of the pop culture rebellion we see today is actually just brilliant, calculated corporate counter-programming? Think about that next time you see a brand claiming to break all the rules.